This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week we come to you from the Fairmont Pacific Rim in Vancouver, here for the annual Virtuosa Symposium. I've been coming to Vancouver for almost 40 years. Dating back to my days as a correspondent to Newsweek. I always loved this city. Of course, how could you not love a city that's on the water and surrounded by water and great food, great ethnic food, and a great hub for going just about anywhere north, east, and maybe even west, if you don't mind crossing an ocean. And my next guest is also a transplant to Vancouver. And he's a civic historian and author, but what the cool thing is about John Atkin is that he literally conducts great walking tours of this city. And John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I still look at Vancouver, even though you've seen it and I've seen explosive growth.
Mm-hmm.
And the Winter Olympics 7 years ago didn't hurt, I mean, in terms of that growth.
Yep.
In fact, they prepared for it. But I remember sailing in here in 1984 when they opened up Pacific Place here,
yep.
Right? And the first cruise ship was the Nordam. I was on
goodness.
It,
yeah.
You know, it was like this gleaming white city, gleaming and still gleaming white over there.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as big as it's gotten, I still look at Vancouver as a manageable city.
It's incredibly manageable, and I think one of the things that sets Vancouver apart from most major North American cities is that a couple of things. We've got an amazing transit system where transit ridership rises 5% every year on average. And there isn't a freeway or interstate that crosses the city at all. So it is very much a local street network. It's a very walkable city. 20% of the commute in the morning is by foot. 18% is by bicycle.
Name another city like that.
And we are the only North American city where 51% of the morning commute within the city boundaries is done by means other than a private automobile. So it becomes much more of a different city than most other places.
I'll tell you what's different about it, and you'll get a kick out of this, I think. I was up here about, oh God, this goes back at least 10 years, and I was walking downtown, and I got lost. And a police car came by, and I flagged him down. I said, hey, listen, could you tell me how I could get here? He said, hop in. He took
yeah.
me. That doesn't happen.
No, we're actually, despite the sort of Canadian sort of reputation for being slightly off-putting or a little bit cold, we're actually quite a friendly place here. And you know, you often see people with maps out kind of looking puzzled, and almost anyone will walk up and say, hey, where are you going? What do you need? And how can I get you there?
Now, for me, I remember, I mean, I had my favorite restaurants here 40 years ago. One of them's gone already, but mm-hmm. it was great. And you had the neighborhoods, you know. And then, yeah. of course, in the early 90s, you had such an exit of Chinese from Hong Kong prior to the handover to the mainland Chinese that you had a huge infusion of Chinese in mm-hmm. Vancouver, yeah. which was a great brain drain for China, but a great brain addition to Vancouver.
Oh, an incredible addition, because we've historically always had a very large Chinese population here. We've had the second largest historic Chinatown in North America since 1911. And we've always had that Chinese presence. But what's interesting is you have that Cantonese, mainland Chinese in the original immigration. You've got that Hong Kong from the 80s, 90s. And now you just have mainland Chinese immigration as well. And that means you can find everything from really good San Francisco-style Chinese right up to some of the most amazing Mandarin cooking. And now you can go back to Hong Kong and find restaurants that serve Vancouver-style Chinese, because the food has actually morphed into a different style. And so the food scene here is amazing.
Well, I always like to ask the locals, and since you are one, John,
mm-hmm.
if people are listening to the show, and they better be listening to the show, if they're coming to Vancouver, where would you take them to either breakfast, lunch, or dinner that's not in the guidebook, not in the brochure, but very cool?
Well, since most of my walking tours are in offbeat parts of the neighborhood,
keep going.
If I had a group of folks for breakfast, I would take them over to the downtown east side, which would make a lot of people in this city shudder, and I would take them up to the Ovaltine Cafe.
Okay, and why would they shudder?
Downtown east.
First of all, the name itself is a little bit dated. Ovaltine. I love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Ovaltine sits right in the middle of what is the shorthand for everything that's wrong with Vancouver. If journalists come to the city, and during the Olympics, for instance, you came to the city, wow, this is an amazing place. There's something wrong with it. Where is it? And it's Main and Hastings Street. That's our low-income area, and it's got, you know, a bit of a drug problem, things. But it's also a very cool, interesting, stable neighborhood. So the Ovaltine is a 1942, good old-fashioned, long-counter booth coffee shop that still serves really atrociously bad diner coffee, which is part of the whole thing. New owners the last couple of years, they've upgraded the cheeseburgers without changing the cheeseburgers. They're just good now.
I won't even go there. Keep going.
And the morning hash is just amazing. So I go there for breakfast. I sit there at the counter.
Okay, so we started the Ovaltine for breakfast. Yep. Now take me to lunch.
Lunch, well, we're going to go over to Chinatown, and we've got now a whole new breed of interesting Asian-themed restaurants there. And a new one, which is a Thai-influenced noodle house called Fat Mao. And these guys serve slightly spicy, but just really amazingly well-prepared noodle dishes in a tiny little spot. And it's just brilliant. So I would take you there for lunch.
All right. Now the big finale, dinner.
Oh, boy. There's so much that's absolutely amazing out there. But what I would probably do is take you out to the city of Richmond and go to the Richmond Center Mall. You walk
to the mall.
To the mall.
I'm getting a little scared here. Go ahead.
You walk to the end of the mall in the south end, and then you walk out towards the arm that goes out to Number 3 Road, and there's a tiny little Chinese seafood slash dim sum place there that serves some of the most astounding seafood, some of the most astounding dim sum, and I would take you there.
Is there always a line out in front of it?
It's interesting. It has a bit of a lineup at certain points, yeah, but it generally doesn't. And we've always managed to just walk in. But
and
the
what's
food,
the name of it?
You just
gave me the direct. You just know how to get there.
I just know how to get
so
there.
So you go to the mall in Richmond.
Go to the mall in Richmond, the Richmond Center Mall, head to the arm at the end of the mall for Number 3 Road.
And what do you order there? Do you have a particular dish?
They have a salted and spicy squid dish that is just exquisite because it is hot to the point of almost being too hot, and yet the saltiness kills the heat. The squid and the things is just the most exquisitely well-cooked dish.
And, of course, the beer kills everything.
Yeah, exactly.
You forgot the beer, John.
Sorry.
Toto, I'm repeating, we're not in Kansas anymore.
Scared about my next guest because he was voted Canada's best bartender, and he's right here at the hotel, and also fourth best bartender in the world.
That's correct.
This is very scary.
Exciting.
It's exciting, and you know, in the old days probably was like 5 years ago, you would never expect a hotel, with a couple of exceptions in major gateway cities, to have a truly cutting edge bar. It was basically, you know, their restaurant menu items were like meat and potatoes, and the bar was basically, you know, martinis and Manhattans and whatever. That's not the case here.
No, not at all. And I mean, even now there's been a big resurgence in hotel bars and the classic styles of cocktails they're doing, and even pushing the envelope and being some of the leading bars in the world.
Now, the accent that I'm hearing?
Australian.
Known for your drinking, of course. With two hands, please.
It's our hobby is also my job.
All right, so now, is there such a thing as a signature cocktail here?
We don't have a signature for the hotel, no, but there is a signature cocktail for the city, which is what I'm probably going to make for you shortly. But
Vancouver has its own cocktail.
Correct. The original cocktail, the Vancouver cocktail, was created in English Bay at the Sylvia Hotel.
And by the way, there's such a thing as a Singapore Sling. There's the Sazerac in New Orleans.
Yep.
Right, and here it's called what?
The Vancouver cocktail.
Did they have a committee meet on that?
Well, you've got the Manhattan that's from Manhattan. You've also got Toronto from Toronto. So there's
okay,
a few,
fine.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so run me through this. What is in the famous Vancouver cocktail?
So it was created in 1954, and it's got gin, sweet vermouth, Benedictine, and orange bitters. We've done a slight, so we've managed a slight variation of a martini. So the martinis come from San Francisco, but then it took 80 years for our variation to come up to Vancouver and us kind of twist it slightly and take out one ingredient out of another.
Okay, which one did you take out?
Took out maraschino and added Benedictine.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
And gin. Any particular kind of gin?
Well, so that's why we have the Vancouver number two that we're doing today. Is we've essentially taken this classic drink and made it as local in Vancouver as we could. So we're using a local gin made downtown right here in Vancouver.
Right.
We're using a Odd Society bitters just down the road, and we're using a local bitters as well, orange bitters.
So it's all local?
All local.
All right, so let's talk about that. What do you do?
Well, I've already made it already here. The interesting thing about this drink that we sort of played to when we made... keep this quiet.
And this is, ladies and gentlemen, this is radio. I want you to know this, okay? Now, what did you just do there? You have a glass. Oh, you took out the water that melted from the ice, right?
I've got a mixing glass full of ice. I'm just straining off the water so there's no excess water. You want to control the dilution. I've actually got a pre-batch of the drink here in a bottle. This is to signify that when we're actually building the last bar, Botanist, just that we just opened last week, as an ode to the city, we actually took a bottle time capsule, and before they put the stone on top of the bar, the marble, we actually buried one into the bar top with a note to the future bartenders with our opening cocktail menu.
So just in case there's a civil disturbance and they have to break up the bar, yeah.
Well, in 30 or 40 years when they actually go to re-renovate the bar or whatever, they'll reopen it up and there'll be a note from the opening bar team saying, first drinks on us.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now you're pouring.
So it's all pre-mixed, so I'm just going to put that one into there. We're stirring.
Yes, can you hear the ice being stirred, ladies and gentlemen? Thank you so much, yes. Okay.
It's just stirring versus shaking because it's all straight liquor components. There's no sugars or acidities that we want to really ruffle together, so we just want to treat it nice and
gently. Now, while you're stirring that,
yes.
What's the most popular drink at this hotel? It's not going to be the Vancouver.
No, it's an old-fashioned, actually.
Really?
Yeah, we sell probably four or five times more old-fashions than any other cocktail.
And what's in an old-fashioned? Help me out.
A whiskey, either rye or bourbon, bitters, and sugar.
And that's it?
That's it. It's a classic-style drink, essentially just a few elements with obviously a little bit of dilution. Ooh. I seem to not have a vessel.
That's okay. We can make this work here. There it is.
Into my very fancy martini glass.
Uh-huh. It's radio. No one's going to know. Okay.
Spritz with a little bit of lemon oils.
That's it?
Yep, that's it.
Oh my God, okay, he's moving it over towards me. Ooh, that's nice.
It's like a bit of more herbal martini, if you will.
Yeah, and before you know it, you're basically slammed.
You'd probably have one before dinner. I wouldn't recommend having three or four consecutively.
No, neither would I.
No.
All right, so... Old Fashioned is the one.
Old Fashioned's the one, followed very closely by Martini's mini variation.
And Cosmopolitans are dead now?
No, they're not dead. They're still there. People like that comfort order if they're not used to ordering cocktails.
Right. And your favorite drink?
A Negroni. Negroni is a classic cocktail, three ingredients, similar to the drink we just made you, but a little bit more bitter.
All right.
Yeah?
I love this. It's radio. No one can know how much I'm drinking right now. This is perfect.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
I give myself a one museum rule. I will only go to one museum because if I do more, my eyes will glaze over. I really want to have that immersive experience and see it. I had an amazing experience in Montreal at their Museum of Art. And there's a museum here in Vancouver that people don't take enough notice of because people don't realize the history that's in this part of the world. It's the Museum of Anthropology. And here from the Museum of Anthropology, Dr. April Liu, how are you?
I'm doing great.
So you heard my introduction. I mean, we're talking thousands of years.
That's right. And I'd like to welcome you all to Vancouver and thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, this is a pleasure, yeah.
And welcome to the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Salish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations peoples.
And you see, that's what people don't get. They don't realize how deep the history goes.
That's right. And Vancouver City Council actually voted to recognize that we are on unceded territory. And maybe for your American audiences, they don't use this term so often, but unceded meaning not surrendered, never given over by war or treaty to the settlers, the colonial settlers that came.
Exactly. So you still retain, at least in spirit, if not in law, that right.
That's right. We acknowledge every day at the museum that we're on the, you know, the ancestral territories of the Musqueam people. We remind the visitors, and it's kind of
basically
become a part of culture here.
Basically, yeah. What you're saying is you're renting.
We consider ourselves very privileged visitors.
Exactly.
And guests, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that history, because that history is displayed at the museum.
That's
people
right.
get a chance to see that it doesn't go back five years, 10 years, 100 years, 300 years. It goes back thousands.
At least 15,000. You know, there's, you know, we're celebrating Canada 150, but Vancouver, the city of Vancouver has added a plus to that, 150 plus, to acknowledge, as we should, that there's been cultures here for thousands of years, not just 150 years of colonialism.
So what are you actually showing in a way that people can relate? Because one of my biggest challenges at museums is either they're trying to be so hip that people appreciate it for the hipness, but not about the history, or they're just like presenting it in a way that people can't relate to it.
That's right. The most incredible thing about our museum is the integration of the museum itself and the landscape. So the first thing that your attention is brought to, even when you're inside, you're looking through the glass, you see the ocean, you see the cliffs, the cedar trees around you. And within this environment, you're looking at the historic cultural belongings of the Indigenous peoples of Canada. This is in the Great Hall of the Museum of Anthropology. So you've got the old totems. We even have the Haida House that's outside on the bluffs overlooking the ocean. And so just by being on the land and being in that natural environment, I think you're reminded of the history of the land.
What's amazing to me, and you mentioned the totems, if you look at the South Pacific nations and the islanders, they did their storytelling on tree bark, and they told storyboards. They were storyboards that just went on. Sometimes they went 8 or 9 feet.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
You've just done it as vertical. That's the totems. That's the storyboard that you're telling.
That's right.
It just needs to be interpreted.
That's right. And we have daily tours at the museum. We have special tours. And we have also many rotating exhibits that happen. So if people are coming this year, they'll see actually an exhibit on contemporary Asian art, calligraphy, and script. They'll also see a show on Amazonia, which is called Amazonia, the Rights of Nature. So we're actually quite global in nature, the museum. We're a place of world arts and culture.
But let's go back. I'm going back to the totems.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, what's the most surprising totem that you have there that tells the most intricate story?
There's one that I really love. It doesn't stand out necessarily visually when you first walk in, but the story behind it is so interesting. It's from the Gitanyau community of northern BC.
Explain that.
And what's incredible about this totem is that when...
No, tell me about the community.
The community, it's in northern BC. It's in a First Nations community up in Gitanyau, and the totem was initially, the university approached to purchase this. At first they refused, and then they came back with an offer that we will sell this to you if you agree to record our histories and our knowledge and teach it in your universities.
How
and
cool
give us money to recarve new poles. And so...
And that was a deal you said, right, done.
Yes, and that was in the 50s, and it was historic because it was the first time, Indigenous histories were taught in universities here in Canada.
And now you can go see that totem and learn the story.
Exactly.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go.
I've been saying this all along about the food scene here in Vancouver. I've been coming up for over 40 years. It's never disappointed me. I always have a great time. Of course, I'm one of those guys who always goes back to the same places because I like them already. But you don't have to do that because there are new restaurants opening up all the time, including one that just opened up in this hotel called The Botanist. But the person who knows all about this because he lives it, and what I find particularly fascinating is he was a litigator for 10 years, and then one day woke up and said, no more law, food, feed me. His name is Neil McLennan. He's the food editor at Vancouver Magazine. How are you, man?
I'm great, Pete. How you doing?
No more law, just food.
No more law, just food, yeah. It's a pretty good trade most days. I'll cop to that for sure.
Although, of course, what you're really doing is you're litigating the food now.
I guess that's right. There's judgment being passed by me and, I suppose,
A jury of one, I think.
Exactly. It's much easier for sure.
Now, I mean, there's so much great food here, and there's so much, it's such a diversity of food here. here. Of course, I always come up with the Chinese or even the Japanese. I used to live at Tojo's. I mean, that's you mentioned Tojo's to most people in Vancouver. They go, yeah. Yeah, because it's been here so long.
Yeah, we take it for granted, the idea that we have world-class. It's a phrase we use all the time, world-class, but Tojo's is just, oh yeah, Tojo's, it's great, and sometimes we lose perspective on
how good it is.
Yeah, for sure.
When I first came up here, here's how I date myself. Umberto's.
Yeah, sure.
Right? And
yeah.
He had more than one, by the way.
Sure.
Right?
He's back again, by the way. He has a new restaurant, the latest incarnation, so he is back in the game.
Okay. Umberto's was, of course, Italian. Then there was a restaurant that I fell in love with near Chinatown, not far from the Hotel Vancouver. It then closed, called The Only Cafe.
Sure.
Remember that?
Yeah.
It was a counter with 9 seats. They threw fish in the window. That was it.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
Right? What's changed for you, though, in the last couple of years? Because what really put you guys on the map, because Vancouver stepped up their game for the Winter Olympics. That was 7 years ago.
I think so.
So now what's happened?
I mean, really, I think it's a confluence of a few things. You've hit two right off the bat. Chinese, it's always been a huge part of our culture. The first times you would have been coming here, it would have been largely the immigration from Hong Kong when the handover came.
Yeah, a lot of people ran out of there for that. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that gave us a huge influx of Cantonese restaurants. And I still feel like outside of Hong Kong, we really are one of the great world capitals for that. But in the last couple of years, we've had a huge influx of mainland Chinese. So from Shanghai, from Beijing, and from other points. And that's given us a whole new element. So it's no longer a one-note take, even a good one-note take on Chinese cuisine. It really is a cuisine of the entire mainland China and the Cantonese and Hong Kong. And then Japanese has continued to become, I mean, it used to be, people used to think of Japanese food as synonymous with sushi, and Tojo started out as being one of the great sushi masters in the world, the inventor of the California roll, allegedly. But now we have izakaya, we have different types of sushi.
You have Miku, right?
We have Miku. It's not that far from here. One of the few places.
You can walk to it right from here.
You can walk to it right from here. One of the few places that has a view. You probably notice that for a city that's so beautiful and is on the ocean, we don't have that many restaurants that
have a view.
Miku has view. They do a buri sushi, which again, when they brought it here, probably 5 or 6
what
years
ago,
I guess.
What is that?
It's a really lightly seared sushi, so it's still, by all intents and purposes, raw. But they take a blowtorch and just sear it a little bit, sometimes with a slight topping on top, so it caramelizes a little bit. Really interesting. It's a fantastic sort of.
Well, I gotta check that out.
And now they started 5 or 6 years ago. I would think there's probably 24 places now that have now tried to do their own take on a buri sushi. So that's one. And one of the cuisines that we have not talked about, but is huge, is South Asian or Indian cuisine.
Yeah.
After the Chinese community, that's our largest immigrant community. Huge parts of the city and the whole region has.
Okay, so I got to ask you, where do you go for your best naan bread?
Well, I mean, really, it's terrible to say because it's the obvious one, but Vidge's is, out of all the restaurants, if you woke me up in the middle of the night and say, what is your most iconic restaurant in Vancouver, I would still have to say Vidge's. It's our fundamental Indian restaurant, but it was the first one to take ingredients, French classical preparation with Indian ingredients to the highest level. And I still think, I'm still happy to say to anyone with a straight face, you find me a better Indian restaurant in North America and I'm buying, because I still think it's one of our classic places. Famous for its line, no reservations. Now, everybody doesn't take reservations now, especially in Vancouver, but all throughout North America you go to places and it's cool and hip to have no reservations. Vidge's was the original, absolutely no reservations.
Just show up.
I mean,
and wait.
And wait, like everybody, Harrison Ford, our current prime minister, when he was an MP, had to stand in line and wait like everyone else. It's one of the great democracies of our food scene, is standing in line and waiting with interest.
Hello? This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
If you're just joining us, you know that I've been coming to Vancouver for about, well, I'm not going to tell you how long, it's too embarrassing, but long enough to tell you how much I still love this place. It's grown unbelievably, but at the same time, it's still a manageable city. It's still a very green city. And when it comes to food, there are a few cities that can match it. And my next guest knows all about that. She's a Top Chef Canada judge, TV personality, but most importantly, she's a local and started a great website, followmefoodie.com, and an extreme foodie. Her name is Mijun Pak. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Mijun, what's an extreme foodie?
What's an extreme? I live and breathe this. I mean, I love, like a lot of people say, oh, okay, food is my passion and whatnot, but this is literally what I do every single day. Try new restaurants, explore ingredients. We will go to the ends of the earth to find a restaurant that we had read about, or we'll wait forever to get on a reservation list and do everything we can do to try a certain dish or restaurant that we read about or we heard about through somebody else who is just as crazy as we are.
Now, is it true that they're opening more restaurants here every day? I mean, it's just getting crazy.
They are. They're also closing a lot of restaurants, unfortunately, because the rent is so high. But there are a lot of restaurants opening up, for sure.
Now, when I first came here, and I'm going to date myself, but when I first came here, there was, you know, there was Umberto's, of course, mm-hmm. and right the Italian. And there was this crazy place that I love called The Only Cafe, but it closed. It was this crazy little fish place near Chinatown. But then there was Tojo's, right? Now, Tojo, for those of you who don't remember this, I mean, he's not just a sushi chef. He's reportedly the guy who invented the California roll. So that's what I hear. Mm-hmm. But I still go there all the time. But there's great Chinese. There's great Japanese. There's great Indian. I mean, you never run out, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's really interesting. I mean, Tojo-san, also a friend, I would have to say when he came to Vancouver, he really pioneered fine dining Japanese when it didn't really exist. When people were kind of unfamiliar with Japanese cuisine. We had lots of immigration then, and people were unfamiliar with sushi and how to eat sushi. And so I know a lot of people debate, like, who really invented the California roll. Tojo-san says, you know, he did. In LA, there's someone says that he did. And it was a way, basically, it was a way to get people who were unfamiliar with sushi to try sushi.
Oh, and by the way, yeah. You go to a sushi restaurant now and you order California roll, they go, why?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, it's like, oh, that's like so old.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, I don't know if it's old as much as it's just become like a, like it's like the...
It's like a Ritz cracker of sushi.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it was, you know...
I just came up with that, by the way. I thought it was pretty good.
I was trying to think of the same thing. I'm like, it's like a burger. I don't even know how to... But no, it's like a Ritz cracker. It's kind of... Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have as much respect, especially because lots of places use... fake crab, right? They use pollock meat.
It's like cod or something. It's crazy.
They use like pollock meat. Yeah. So it's just like cheap fish. But you can find places that use real crab. Of course, you're going to be paying more than that, but that's expected as well. But we've definitely become more sophisticated. And I'd like to think that we've definitely broadened ourselves from the California roll that we've learned to also embrace.
I went to a Japanese restaurant the other day and there was a sign on the window saying, no California roll. No,
I love it. Where was it?
It was in Los Angeles. It was West LA. So no California roll, no spicy tuna. Don't ask.
I love that.
Because the sushi chef was supposed to say, I've had it with that. Let's do something more adventuresome, you know? Mm-hmm.
I do think that's happening in Vancouver as well, too. I mean, it used to all be about, you know, rolls and sauces and all of this stuff and cream cheese and rolls and da-da-da. And those have
The Philadelphia roll.
Yeah, exactly, the Philadelphia roll. Yeah. And those sushi rolls, they have their places. And, like, with all the kimchi on it and all these sauces, they have their places. And it's not that they taste bad, but it just takes away from what traditional Japanese sushi is about.
Okay, Mijun, here's my question. Where do you go?
For Japanese sushi?
Yeah, we'll go through the whole list. Japanese.
Okay, let's say. Well,
other than Tojo, because that's a natural. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because at the same time, while he did pioneer the fine dining Japanese food scene, it's been a long time since he's opened. There's a lot of new chefs that have also opened Japanese restaurants. Yeah. I am a traditionalist. I do prefer edamame nigiri, which is classic fish and rice. That's it. They sauce it for you and everything. I can tend to be a purist when it comes to sushi. And so I just want the simplest form, fish on rice. And did you know, actually,
no Philadelphia roll for you. You're not going to have any cream.
You know, it has its place. If I want to spend those dollars or go there, then I'm going to do that. Okay. But then otherwise, I go traditional. And a few places I'd like for that is Sushi Hachi in Richmond. It's a really tiny
Richmond's
place.
Richmond's a neighborhood in Vancouver.
Absolutely. It's a suburb in Vancouver. And they open maybe 3-4 days a week for 3 hours a day. And this is a husband and wife operation. I sit at the bar and I do omakase there. And that's a kind of really special spot that not many people know about if you're looking for sustainable. I literally just had sushi downstairs at the Fairmont Pacific Rim. So Taka-san, he teaches sushi classes, but he also does all sustainable seafood.
Well, you know what's really cool about that place? It's open till 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right. But the thing is he does a roll that I have total respect for. And it's one of my favorite rolls in the city. If I'm going down the roll route, is the sable fish roll he does. Sablefish.
Now we're in a deli.
Sablefish, aka black cod, right? I mean, it's just a fancy name to get people back then to pay more for what was just black cod.
Exactly.
But his sablefish down there is buttery, it's delicious, it's flavorful, it's smoky, it's one of my favorite rolls if I'm going to have a roll in the city.
But the cool thing is the place is open late.
Mm-hmm.
You don't find that with most sushi restaurants.
No, you don't. Well, it depends. I guess in Vancouver, you don't really, unless you go the really affordable route.
Yeah.
Then you have some places that are open later. There's also, what else do I really like? There's also Masayoshi, which is, he used to work for Tojo-san.
Yeah.
And so he worked for him for over 10 years before opening his own restaurant. And he does only 8 sushi seats at the bar, no California rolls, no spicy tuna rolls. You know, this is what you're going to do. You're going to do 17 pieces or 12 pieces.
So he's like the soup Nazi. He's the soup Nazi.
But he's too sweet to be a Nazi. He's like, he's so sweet. And then most of the time, I there's a communication barrier for us, but most of the time it's just a lot of smiling and nodding. That's like Taka-san downstairs, a lot of smile and nodding, but he speaks English very well, so it's really sweet.
He understands the word sablefish.
Yeah, oh, totally.
Okay, that's very cool. Hey, by the way, it's called Follow Me Foodie.
Yes.
Follow Me Foodie or Foodies?
Follow Me Foodie, D-I-E.
.com.
.com.
Mei Jun Park, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate that.
There you go. Keep that going. This is Flight 372 on SWA. The flight attendants on board serving you today. Teresa in the middle, David in the back. My name is David and I'm here to tell you that. Shortly after takeoff, first things first, there's soft drinks and coffee to quench your thirst. But if you want another kind of drink, then just holler. Alcoholic beverages will be $4. If a Monster energy drink is your plan, that'll be $3 and you get the whole can.
I've been coming to Vancouver for over 40 years and I'm always astounded. I'm a New York City boy, so anytime I see green, I'm a happy guy. And the first thing you see when you get to Vancouver, you don't have to look far, is Stanley Park. And what an amazing, large city park it is. And that's just one of a number of green areas in this city that helps to define it. And joining me now, somebody who knows a little bit about that, the board chairman of the Vancouver Park Board, Michael Weeb. How are you, man?
Good. Thanks for having me.
I mean, you heard my introduction about Stanley Park. I mean, it's pretty cool.
And if you're from New York, Stanley Park's actually bigger than Central Park, so we kind of like to hold that.
Thank you for reminding me. And by most city park standards, Central Park's pretty big.
It is.
But, I mean, it's more than just Stanley Park here.
Yeah, we have over 240 parks, and the first thing our city council did over 100 years ago was create an elected board. So our board's actually an elected board that's just here to make sure that we have more parks and our parks continue to stabilize.
Well, actually, I would assume based on most cities, your platform is not just to have more parks, but not to have less.
Yes. Well, and right now, I mean, like you said, we're growing as a city. And so we've got all this new opportunity on the waterfront, and we're creating new 23-acre, 13-acre parks, just one after another. So as we move away from some of the industrial...
And you have the land to do that?
We do have the land to do it because we're moving away from some of the industrial businesses. We're creating clean jobs. We've got a lot of tech companies coming here that don't utilize the waterfront. So we're moving them inside, and we're able to take advantage of that waterfront and build these beautiful parks and daylight new creeks. And we're doing a lot here for biodiversity.
Do you have specific parks that are designated for specific activities?
Yeah, and that's always the biggest thing is how much do you activate a park versus passive space? I mean, Stanley Park's got great trails and just places that you can just sit on a bench.
And it always has.
Yeah, but other parks that are more urban settings, sometimes it gets really complicated on how many things you need to put into it. We've got this many dog owners, this many people playing tennis, you have this many people want to play pickleball. You have all these kind of activities that you can't fit in one space.
How many dogs want to play pickleball?
Not very many.
Okay, good. I'm just double checking. But the thing is, you mentioned dogs. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And you got to create that space.
Yeah, and we're creating a whole new dog strategy because of the amount of dogs. We have hundreds of thousands of dogs now in the city of Vancouver. And so our dog versus space has become a big issue and one that normally people don't deal with. But our board is taking it on head on, and we're dealing with a big issue this year.
Have you gotten to the point where you've had to limit the number of dogs per park?
Not yet, but we were looking at what type of parks work and how we can create more space and small space. And dogs need a place to run, but it's not always in our parks, you can't just have dogs running around everywhere. So we're working to do a good balance where dogs can have their space. And we're even doing our outdoor agility. Like, we're looking at different options, outdoor play parks, spray parks for dogs. I mean, dogs need to have a good time as well. And so we're trying to find that balance.
Is there a park in Vancouver where dogs can just take off and run?
Yeah, we've got some good outdoor ones that have good space. We have some beaches that some of our nicest beaches in Vancouver are actually dog beaches. So Extension and the one by Maritime Museum. If anyone gets a chance, they are the two most beautiful beaches for watching the sunset. And they're also dog-friendly beaches.
No, they're the two most beautiful beaches for watching dogs watch the sunset.
Yes. Well, and for people that want to watch dogs watch the sunset, come on down to these two beaches because they're stunning.
And you have to keep them on a leash?
No, not those beaches.
Really?
Those are dog off-leash beaches that lead to off-leash trails. And so we have some fantastic areas in Vancouver where we can leave your office and be at a secluded beach in 5 minutes. And they look very natural. And so it's very different than other cities that are really kind of designed and kind of everything's got their own contour, right? This is a little bit more.
And then how do you build in the green technology?
So green technology is kind of what we can do to advance it, taxation and different ways that we can kind of bring people in. It's also, we're lucky with our background. So we attract a lot of people to Vancouver just because, like you said, today's a gorgeous day and we're sitting
right now just on
window.
The show. We've attracted a lot of dogs to Vancouver. I want you to know that.
Yeah, and they should, because we're a dog friendly city. Whistler's a dog friendly city. I mean, we're looking at some of the beautiful trails we have that are off leash that you can get out in 10 minutes and be up in the hills.
Wow. But when we talk about green technology, what, I mean, in terms of being able to lessen the carbon footprint, in terms of lessen the actual energy use, I mean, I see buildings right around this hotel that have grass roofs.
Yeah, the one that's, we're right across from our new convention center has one of the largest grass roofs, and it's also utilizing the water. So it pumps some of its heat into the water and it cools it to come back into the building. So we're utilizing not only the ocean, but we're using the air and everything else to create these green buildings. And we're trying to be the greenest city. And so that's pushing technology and it's pushing ideas forward. And it's making the politicians in Vancouver make sure that when they do make a decision, they put that green lens in.
Because they can lose their seat if they don't.
Because this is a city that takes greenery as a key component to what makes their life happy.
But you don't take it overly seriously. I mean, you know, that's the point where everything has to be green.
No, and that's where there's a good range. I mean, right, people are going to have to drive. We're looking at different options. But you have to come with a balance where having access to greenery, and that's been a big one, is we want to have every single person who lives in Vancouver to be within a five-minute walk of a park. So it might not be a big park, right? We don't need large green spaces in every neighborhood.
But you need the spaces.
We need the spaces, and you need to be able to get to a green space because it's really good for your health.
Yeah, I want to come back to a park where the dogs drive to the park.
Yeah.
No? Okay.
No.
We draw the line.
Well, and that's the thing is that people, some of our points right now, we have dog parks that you have to drive to. And so we need to create more smaller parks where people can take their dog walk.
The key is to walk.
The key is to walk.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Now our radio clearance, over.
That's Clarence, over.
Over. Roger.
Huh?
You heard me speak earlier in the show. What I love so much about Vancouver, among so many other things, is the great diversity in food, all the great ethnic choices, and I'm talking about seriously great choices. And my next guest exemplifies that. Born in India, he's worked in Dubai, he's worked in Singapore, and now he's making his home right here in Vancouver. He's from New Delhi. Karan Suri, how are you, sir?
Thank you.
The executive chef right here at the hotel. I mean, when you think about what you can bring to the party here, because you have so much opportunity for sourcing stuff, right? You have no difficulty getting seafood at this place.
Absolutely. We are very enamored by the seafood and everything fresh that's available on the West Coast. So
I'll tell you what's really cool about this hotel, and I just found this out. You have a sushi bar in the lobby.
Yes.
It's open till 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
How cool is that? And they got the award for being the most responsible in terms of their fish choices, in terms of overfishing.
Yes. So we, within Fairmont, work with OceanWise, which is the sustainable fishing option, or the group that basically governs that. And most of our hotels are 100% OceanWise, which means we support sustainable seafood and we support the choices that people make by eating local and wild and sustainable food.
And you've got a new restaurant that just opened up in this hotel, right?
The Botanist.
Yeah. Just like a day ago.
Yes.
Just about. Is there such a thing as Vancouver cuisine?
Well, Vancouver cuisine exists. Pacific Northwest is what a lot of people call it as. But what's so great about Vancouver as a food scene is the diversity is what you can get here. And that's what really makes the overall cuisine so exciting, because you can get everything.
So basically I can get great Pacific oysters in the Northwest and non-bread.
and naan bread.
Garlic naan bread.
Garlic naan bread.
Now we're talking.
Yeah.
What would you say, because you've been here about 3 years now, so what would you say is your signature dish, if you have one?
Well, it's very hard to pick up a signature dish, but of course I love working with the local seafood here in BC. Spot prawns is something that does come straight to my head. It's only available for a certain period of time, and it's starting very soon. And I love playing around with flavors. I also worked in Africa, so some couple of North African flavors with spot prawns is my current go-to dish.
Okay, when you say a couple of North African flavors, such as?
Such as using shermoula, using duka.
Explain that.
So shermoula is basically a spice base that you would make with paprika, cumin, tomatoes, lemon juice, parsley, olive oil. And then duka is basically a spiced nut mix where we use some local hazelnuts, some cumin, some coriander. So just basically amping up a lot of flavors in a few bites and taking something from here, transporting it to North Africa, and then bringing it back.
Basically, you sound like a chemist. I mean, when you think about it.
Well, most chefs are. I mean, they're more than chemists. They're artists. They're crazy soldiers. They are like so many things that a lot of people do not know about. But yes, we just love to experiment with flavors and textures and tastes and how the dish looks.
Now, I ask this of every chef, so bear with me. But is there a dish that you put on the menu here that you thought everybody is going to love this dish and it completely tanked? And conversely, is there a dish you think, I'll put it on the menu, but who's ever going to want this? And everybody did.
Well, there's always that choice, that hard choice that chefs have to make. I sometimes joke with my team and I tell them that there are two types of dishes, one that chefs like and one that people like. And one of the very good examples that I can think of recently is that we basically dehydrated beef tendons and puffed them into crisps that were served with a spicy togarashi aioli. And everybody in the kitchen went like, wow, this is so amazing. This is the new chicharron. This is the new puff. This is the new nuts. Probably not ordered. We've probably had like very few guests order that.
Is it still on the menu?
It is on the menu.
Barely.
Yes. We're going to intend to keep it.
Oh, you're going to keep it?
Yes.
Okay.
Because whoever has had it has said that, wow, they never thought. So, and one of the examples of dishes that I think most of my fellow chefs would agree with me is a Caesar salad. You know, that's something pretty boring, something that people would go like, oh, it's a Caesar salad. But then you have no idea.
What makes your Caesar salad so special?
Well, the first thing is that we mix a little bit of kale in our Caesar salad. We only use white anchovies. We use a really nice young Parmesan cheese from Reggiano, which has got a nice, soft, rich flavor. But at the end, it's a Caesar salad.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
If you're coming up to Vancouver or anywhere else in British Columbia, it is a rite of passage. It is a ritual. I know very few cruise ship passengers who do not take up the opportunity to do this. Most of my friends have done it at least once. I've done it too. You go over to Victoria, to another hotel that used to be one of the old Canadian Rail hotels called the Empress, now part of the Fairmont chain, and you go there for high tea. And it's quite the ritual. And if you haven't done it, you have to do it at least once. I mean, people just have to do it. And joining me now, the general manager from the Empress, Indu Barra. How are you?
Hi, Peter.
And, by the way, the first female general manager of the hotel ever since it opened in 1908.
That's right.
So it's a hotel that's 109 years old, if I do my math correct.
That's right, this year, in January.
Amazing. So, but explain Victoria, because we're in Vancouver.
It's a beautiful little island, about a 35-minute Harbor Air or Helijet flight over the ferry.
You got to, on a good day like today, you got to take the helicopter.
It's stunning, Absolutely stunning. So Vancouver Island, a beautiful, beautiful area. Victoria is...
By the way, let me explain something about Vancouver Islands. You don't just do the high tea. There's a pod of whales, unbelievable pod of orcas, that a good friend of mine knows about, and now you know about it, and you can go out there and do great whale watching, and the whales are always there. They are always there. And they know each whale by name. They've done sonar stuff. And then from there, do that in the morning, And then go over to the Empress for the high tea.
Come for tea. We've got beautiful afternoon tea at the Empress. 21 loose leaf teas, pastries, clotted cream. Everything made by our.
Oh, you went for the big clotted cream.
Oh, it's addictive. I hate to say it.
Well, this is radio, but the truth be told, you weigh 2 pounds. We hate you. Okay.
Well, you have to be wise when you work at the Empress, and you have all these wonderful options around you day in and day out.
What's special about Victoria? Because people don't realize, and it's so accessible.
Oh, well, it's beautiful. It's nature. It's rugged. It's island living at its most civilized, if you can imagine. You've got, you can go hiking, you can go surfing, you can go whale watching, you can come for afternoon tea.
Did you mention afternoon tea again?
I did.
Stop it.
Okay, what about Q Bar, one of the hottest bars in town? So we've got Pacific Northwest restaurants. The culinary and food scene in Victoria is tremendous. No one thinks about Victoria when you think about wineries. We have beautiful wineries.
Yeah, that's it. People don't know. Within 4 hours of where we are right now, right, we're in Vancouver. I mean, you've got Canadian wineries.
We have Canadian wineries and world-class wines. I mean, this part of the world is it's stunning. There's so much to see and do, and it's just one of my favorite places.
And people don't realize, but I want to put this in some historical perspective. Most Americans discovered Vancouver and Victoria by accident, thanks to a very arcane federal law called the Jones Act. And the Jones Act said that no cruise ship, or any ship whatsoever flagged in a foreign country could sail between two U.S. ports without stopping in a foreign port first. So that's why all the Alaska cruises, or most of them, start in Vancouver, because you can't start in Seattle or San Francisco and go straight to Alaska, because it violates the Jones Act. So people are either going to discover Vancouver and Victoria on the way up or on the way back. And that's how everybody says, hey, let's go over to the Empress and have, let me hear it again, high tea. But that's true.
It is true. And it really is a bucket list thing to do. We hear so much about afternoon tea at the Empress. We've actually just developed a beautiful Empress cake on the inspiration of the Saha Torte in Vienna.
Oh, boy.
We sent our pastry chef to France.
If the scones weren't enough, you have a cake now.
We have a cake.
What's in the cake?
It's a Casey's cake. It's our own chocolate. Our pastry chef went to France.
You make your own chocolate?
We make our own chocolate. We have our own chocolate profile based on the Pacific Northwest. So he was flown over to France. He worked with a wonderful wonderful company there and established our very own chocolate for the Empress.
So when you're having high tea, if it's not enough for all the scones and the pastries and the sandwiches and the high tea, you can then really like gild the lily with
the Empress Torte. It's fabulous.
And you sell a lot of them to go, don't you?
We do. Beautiful cake boxes.
It's just like Vienna. It's all in the box.
It's all in the
every
box.
Every time I go to Vienna, I'm an idiot. Every time I go to Vienna, I'm even at the airport, I say, oh, I better get one. And then I bring it back and it sits in my refrigerator. I look at it and I say, I can't eat that. It's just too heavy.
It's rich.
It is rich, isn't it?
Well, I think our crowning glory on our cake is a beautiful crown that Queen Elizabeth wore. So there's a beautiful crown right on top.
Made out of?
Chocolate.
Thank you. But what about the hotel itself? Because it's one of the traditional grand dames.
It really is, but fully restored. We're just coming off of a 60 million plus restoration. It's not a renovation, it's a transformation. We've done an incredible, incredible job. Brand new lobby, health club, restaurant.
And is it true that the Empress Torte is in every locker in the health club?
Well, it could be. That's a very good idea, Peter. That's good inspiration.
Okay.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.